Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to march forward in our continual quest to explore the cultures of consciousness. One of the more interesting cultures of consciousness that I had the opportunity to investigate and explore in my career as a music journalist, which was pretty dominant in the early to mid-90s of my life, was the expanding world of rave music. I was lucky enough to be in New York, where we got some of the first transcontinental explosions of the UK rave movement in the early 1990s, especially a club called NASA. And I got very into electronic music, less as a raver and dancer and more as a head listening to music at home. But I was bewitched by these alien but also warm and bubbly sounds. And I got a gig in 1993 writing about a big techno tour they put together with Moby was the most famous character, but also the great Orbital and the absolutely genius Aphex Twin, and they were touring across America in a typical rock tour format with rock promoter and the bus and the whole ridiculous thing. Although Moby wasn't on the bus, he insisted on flying. And one day I was talking to the Orbital boys, who were very friendly gents. And just talking about music and rave and such, and they told me about this scene in Goa, in India, in the west coast of India, where there was apparently some very heavy-duty psychedelic electronic dance music scene. And at that time, I was like, "Whoa, that sounds deeply weird. I must check that out." And a year or so later, I got flown out there on Condé Nast's dime to write about this scene, which at that point was transforming from an extremely underground scene, very local, of people coming there and throwing very heavy electronic dance music parties, kind of disconnected from other things, although obviously part of the what was building to be a global rave phenomenon, but still very esoteric. And it was just about the point where the kind of music that people were making there, particularly psychedelicized form of dance music, was just starting to kind of leak out and really begin to influence the world. And it's really that music which, you know, influenced by and combined with other scenes and other genres. But in many ways, the music that came out of Goa at that point flowered into today's global psytrance movement, which to my mind is one of the most interesting global scenes of music and culture that we have now, something that's not really talked about by many people outside of the scene, and yet its extent and dynamics and intensity, especially from the perspective of culture of consciousness, is really quite extraordinary and really worth paying attention to, even if you don't necessarily groove with all the tunes. And luckily today we're going to be talking to Graham St. John, who to my mind is the most indefatigable and rigorous scholar of this material that I know. He's been very active in publishing and organizing books and other writers, including one piece that I did for him for an earlier volume. And he's just come out with his book, Tech Nomad, Global Raving Countercultures. But before we bring Graham on, I'd like to introduce, of course, our resident esoteric librarian, Maja Daou. Maja, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
We don't want to talk all about drugs today, but it's certainly the case that the rave movement and the explosion of rave is correlated, let's say, with the discovery and the enthusiasm around MDMA, and I know in your esoteric library you have some interesting facts here about that. What interests you about MDMA?
Well, I love how it's kind of connotated with the rave culture as this new drug, right? Like it's has this new fresh feeling, and that was part of like the whole rave culture, was that this was something brand new, and techno music was something that had never been done before. But it's totally like ancient shamanic practice of ritual dance and everything. And the drug that they use, MDMA, actually comes from this very old witchy poo shamanic plant called sassafras. One of the main precursors for MDMA comes directly from the sassafras root, which at one point was the second largest export in America next to tobacco. We used it in almost everything. It was primarily used in root beer until the FDA made it illegal, I think partly because of, you know, they found out that it could be used as a drug. But then they also said it was carcinogenic, which is such a joke because now in root beer, of course, there's no real roots. It's all chemicals and high fructose corn syrup. It's a little ridiculous. But sassafras has been used by shamans and witches for thousands of years, and it's also like a huge part of the diet of deer and many animals in the wild. And it was used ritually for purposes much like a lot of the modern-day ravers use it in kind of communal dance rituals and stuff like that. So I always like to remind people about the history of MDMA because everyone thinks it's like this new fashion, like, you know, brand new drug or something.
Right, so even though that the psychoactive effects of old school sassafras root and contemporary synthetic MDMA are different, that there's a sort of family lineage there that reminds us of the ancient roots of the kind of practices that we see.
Oh yeah, and even a lot of the physical properties of MDMA and the sassafras root are similar, like with the anticoagulant properties and stuff like that.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, that's a good one to get us launched. I want to introduce Graham St. John. Graham, thanks for so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks for having me here, Eric.
And where are you? You're on the West Coast now, because I know I wanted to interview you for a while, but the timing with Australia is very rough on you. So, but we had to wait till you're over here on American soil.
That's right. I'm here now. I'm in the Heights, actually, in San Francisco, and I feel like I'm barely here, but I am here. I've just come in from the Cook Islands, where we experienced a total solar eclipse on a boat with a sound system.
Marvelous. How many people were there?
There was 50 to 60 people who made it to that. So we were out there searching for the perfect rave, and I think we found it. Yeah, total solar eclipse events have become, I think, one of the more significant event types in the world of psytrance and eclipse chases and weirdos and adventurers make all sorts of efforts to find themselves in the line of totality, as we did off Rarotonga a couple of weeks ago.
How to describe the scene a little bit? I mean, I've never witnessed it myself. I've had friends who were both eclipse chasers and psytrance fans who have wanted to check those things out, but I haven't heard a report about the combination of the two. I mean, did the music stop? Did it peak in intensity? What was it like when the actual event happened?
Well, this is my third total solar eclipse, and probably the most unusual because it was unlike the two previous events where there were major festivals with thousands of people. This was a fairly small gathering coming out of Melbourne, mostly Melbourneites from Australia. And it's called Black Pearl Eclipse. The Black Pearl was mirrored in the sky about 8 a.m. on July 11, out in the middle of the sea, so 360 degrees of ocean. And it's a remarkable experience for anyone who's experienced it before. It becomes sort of a compelling experience to reproduce it. And my friend John Paris McKenzie, he got together a crew of people, and we sailed out to intercept with that experience. And I mean, it is probably one of the most remarkable cosmic experiences around, I guess, cosmic liminality, because this is the moment when the sun perfectly aligns with the moon, and creates this umbra, this shadow, this line of totality that totality freaks are compelled to experience. So we had a sound system, we had DJs, mostly progressive psychedelic, but also electro. The music did stop before the eclipse itself, which I guess if there's one word to describe it, it's a sense of transfigurement. It's a sense of divine equilibrium. I mean, even though the music itself had stopped and the engines of the ship had stopped and people's stomachs that were previously churning had stopped, because we were sailing overnight through reasonably rough seas. It wasn't that rough, but a lot of us landlubbers were experiencing seasickness. There was this kind of liminal state where people's personal maladies and their seasickness had subsided, and there was almost this like divine music that was coming from the heavens or from the horizon, because this was just after 8 a.m., so the ship was pointing directly at the total solar eclipse. So it was unlike any other eclipse experience I've experienced. It was, you know, only 50 people instead of, you know, thousands of screaming psytrance fans. A remarkable experience.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love the sense of cosmic alignment you mentioned. Just reminded me of probably my favorite outdoor party that I went to when I first went to Goa in '94, and it was in Karnataka in the neighboring state at the ancient ruins of Hampi, and they wanted to throw a party in the ruins, which are these marvelous Hindu, you know, exotic kingdom-looking place, but they weren't allowed to, so they dragged all the sound equipment out to the rocks in the middle of nowhere, and it was on a, you know, full moon, as usually the case. And the morning came, and there was just this moment when we were all dancing, and you could see the sun just rising, and you could see the moon just setting, and even though it was a, you know, generic full moon, nothing magical like an eclipse, nonetheless, I understood, like in my body, the relationship between these two planets and what a full moon meant and what it meant to be in this sort of system in a way that I never had before. And it was something about the dancing and the collective situation. So what I wanted to ask you, though, is that, you know, of course, eclipses have been remarked for, you know, tens of thousands of years, and you know, in some cultures they were seen as sort of disastrous, and in some they were signs of you know, any number of different kinds of cosmic and sacred energies. Why do you think that these days it is psytrance? It is in that scene that you're going to find a kind of culture, a musical culture, a vibrant tribal culture that is sort of hooked into that kind of cosmic event. What is it about psytrance that, you know, maybe even explain to people a little bit about what's particular about that scene or those scenes that overlap with the kind of dance?
That's a very good question, Eric. These, just on the total solar eclipse, these events as, I guess, extreme recreational experiences, that is, you know, making transit to the line of totality from points across the world to observe and to more importantly celebrate that experience seems to have its roots in the early 70s when a group of educators called the Kedis Sigler Group, after failing to mount a rock festival just after Woodstock. This is in the early 70s at the town of Eclipse in Virginia, which was named after an eclipse there in 1900, failed to hold that rock festival because I think the townsfolk there had decided that they didn't want to have a freak out staged in their backyard. Went on to organize these eclipse cruises where they would sail cruise ships into the line of totality from the early 70s and continuing up until the present. They were the first people who were doing that, but it really wasn't until the mid-90s when the advent of the internet and post-rave that psychedelic music had, psychedelic promoters in the psytrance scene had started to promote these events. So I think it was like, excuse me for a second.
It's sort of like an eclipse.
Yeah, so, I'm sorry. Yeah, there was an eclipse rave in Chile in 94, which preceded these events that have evolved for the last decade or so, or the last 15 years. So, but the question of why psychedelic trance has been significant for this is a very interesting question. And I guess one of the reasons is that psytrance has, excuse me.
I think he got sucked into the black hole.
Maybe.
Do you like psytrance, Maja?
You know what? I'm a total non-raver. Which is really funny. But I love the idea of the culture. And actually, one of the things I was thinking about with all this eclipse stuff, you know, it's fascinating to me that with the psytrance, it's part of that, because an eclipse is literally a cosmic example of alchemy. It's the conjunction of the opposites. And in all the alchemical material they talk about, the joining of the sun and moon is the goal of the alchemical procedure. Like, all the goal of alchemy is the joining of the sun and moon. And that's what happens in an eclipse. It's like a cosmic example of the goal of alchemy. And so just like when you can get a bunch of people together and experience that alchemical goal, it is like really deep and gnarly and spiritual. If you are like in that trance state to be underneath it and witness the you know, the goal of the alchemical procedure, I mean, that's really heavy.
Yeah, as I said, I still haven't experienced it. I really mean to. I was going to try to do it this summer, but haven't. Do we have you back, Graham?
Yeah, you do have me back.
All right.
I must apologize. I'm still suffering from jet lag post that alchemical experience. And you were quite right. The sense of divine equilibrium that transpires during that cosmic snapshot that lasts any time between a minute and sometimes I think up to over 4 minutes is quite the experience, and it's a spiritual experience that is certainly alchemical. And I think psytrance is more than any other participants in electronic dance music culture or any other forms of music are destined to be the ones who will promote and will attend such experiences and will expend all their resources to find themselves in that line of totality. If we think of psytrance music as as a form of contemporary electronic new age music where participants are seeking experience and are seeking consciousness and are seeking to evolve their consciousness and are seeking to experience forms of self-realization within those moments. So it's people who are also attracted to yoga and other forms of improving their personal well-being.
Yeah, it seems like that psytrance was able to absorb a lot of the traditions and practices and images and aspirations that were in the more kind of spiritual side of the hippie counterculture, and have brought them to this real intensity and a real sustained kind of intensity. I mean, it's one of the remarkable things about it is it's really been, you know, quite some, you know, a solid 15 years plus of and going back into smaller scenes before that, but even on a relatively accessible stage, and now it's quite quite dominant. I mean, that's one of the things that seems interesting to me about it, is it seems like to be a particularly global scene, not just that everyone around the world, there's some people who are into it and that they have parties in Brazil and Japan and United States and South America and Israel and India and Thailand and all that stuff, because in some ways we're all globalized now. There's scenes, you know, there's heavy metals everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. But there's something specifically global about its outlook and its kind of awareness of itself as a global phenomenon that really, really strikes me. So one of the questions I have for you, because I know you've done so much research, you know, you've got one of these wonderful participant observer jobs, you've done so much research. Can you, how much variation do you sense across the globe in terms of different kinds of events? At what point do they actually go, you know, it's a psytrance festival, or are there really, really strong and striking regional differences between events in Australia or the UK or South America or Japan?
Well, I think there's, to begin with, a strong sense of similarity and familiarity between events across the planet, which is and these events are certainly global. The premier global event would be the Boom Festival, which is about to transpire again in Portugal. It happens every 2 years. And I know that you know about that event, Eric, because I think you've experienced it a few times. And that, to me, is the pinnacle global event, given that people attend that from over 80 different countries. And so you're on a, you can find yourself on a dance floor, which is called the Dance Temple, which is possibly one of the most sophisticated dance floors on the planet, where you're surrounded by the sound bath of languages. Most incredible experience to be on a dance floor with people from potentially over 80 different countries. But that's like the graduation ceremony of the global psytrance experience, and even though the Boom Festival possibly don't identify so much themselves with psytrance anymore, because it's actually fairly, you know, a very eclectic cosmopolitan musical experience. Events across the globe do differ, sometimes quite markedly, and I can't say that I've been to events in every country. I think I need at least 100 research assistants for that. But events in Australia, I have a lot of experience with, and some of the key events there are characterized by a very strong commitment to including indigenous peoples. And so the Rainbow Serpent Festival is quite an incredible experience near Melbourne. They have an opening ceremony that involves indigenous dances and indigenous culture, and that's quite an quite an incredible way of legitimating the experience.
It's interesting because you said earlier that it was part of searching for the perfect rave, and I kind of myself see similarities in part of this global rave culture, which is a little bit reminds me of like early surf culture, like that endless summer kind of thing where they'd be, you know, looking for the perfect wave instead of the perfect rave. But it's this community of people that would, you know, travel all around the globe together in a community in these like kind of very spiritual nature experiences. I mean, I guess it's a little bit different than a rave, but like there seems to be like a little bit of connection between some of the two cultures, and I'm just curious if like if you see any, is there like a lot of surfers that go to raves, or is there connections between that?
Well, maybe one of the connections there is the drive for extreme experiences, mm-hmm. and for perhaps taking a risk and being within a group of people who, and most people travel to these events, especially the global events and also regional events, with, you know, with their own posse, with their own crew. And so there is a sense that people are seeking and experiencing risk, risking their bodies in extreme states of alternate states of consciousness over periods of days, and sometimes these festivals last for days. And so perhaps they're carrying this kind of the flag of being an outsider, of being an outlaw, and transgressing rules and boundaries, and this theme of transgression, I guess, is something that perhaps carries through from some of these other experiences, like surfing, you know, just surfing the edge and desiring to be on the edge.
And just tell me a little bit more about the unusual. I mean, I've heard about Rainbow Serpent. It sounded like one of the more remarkable gatherings on the planet. Could you just say a little bit more about what makes it unusual or special for you?
Well, for me, it's that event is my hometown event. So I've been there at least or well over 10 times. It happens in early. Late January, in the middle of the summer in Australia. It's I think it's a remarkable example of Australian freak carnivalesque. It's really not replicated anywhere else other than some other parts of Australia. But one of the key things about, as I was mentioning before, is that it has an opening ceremony, which for a population of young to middle-aged Australians who are downstream from settlements, living in a post-settler culture, and very much attuned to the history of dispossession experienced by, you know, indigenous populations, are very much receptive to an environment where invited indigenous people, local custodians, are producing a opening ceremony that effectively, symbolically enables the participants in that experience to become at least temporarily legitimate occupants of that space, of that area, of that land, which they will stomp for the next few days, because of course that opening ceremony happens on the main floor. So, in a sense, it's a microcosm of what's happening elsewhere in Australia, where populations downstream from settlement are seeking ways in which they can occupy and live and dwell on a continent with a history of dispossession and maladaptation to ecology.
Yeah, it seems a wonderful example of one of the things I love about festivals is that because they're temporary, they can enact more visionary solutions to larger social problems, ecological problems, and that even though it's done in a way that sort of technically doesn't last, it's not like a fully sustained restructuring of society, it can create a space that allows the experience of a more of an integration that to some degree heals these extraordinary wounds and gestures towards a kind of balance that is otherwise really difficult for people's lives. So I'm really looking forward to asking more questions about the dynamics of these festivals. So we'll be right back on Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis. We're talking with Graeme St. John, and we'll be back shortly after these messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Listen to me every Monday evening at 7 p.m. I'm going to explain to you how less medicine, less pharmaceuticals, less vaccines may actually make you healthier. I'll be live. It'll be a call-in every Monday night at 7 p.m. Please come and join me.
So join in on the conversation at 888-874-4888. Every Monday at 7 with Dr. Eisenstein.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
This is an emergency. No, it isn't. It's an urgency. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with a new show called News Dissector. It's built on the blog that I do every day from MediaChannel.org, dissecting news, analyzing what's happening in the world, offering very cool music and great guests. Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be there for B-Square.
This is Mark Rudd, host of Doing the Spadework, an ongoing conversation about organizing. We're talking with a variety of organizers from around the country who are out there doing the spadework, who are building the basis for the coming social and political movement, what you might call the new civil rights movement. Please join us each week to hear good conversation every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, Progressive Radio Network.
PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and my co-host Eric Davis and I are talking with Graeme St. John about all the fun raviness of raves today. And before the break, Eric had mentioned talking about that kind of communal experience, and you said something which I really love about rave culture, is that you mentioned that these people are getting together with a conscious intention of having an amazing experience. They want it to happen. They're all thinking about it. It's not like they just kind of like wander in or like, oh, we'll have a dance party. But that a lot of the people involved, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them are consciously wanting a kind of religious experience, really. They want to open themselves up to that. And it's always powerful when you get these groups of people that all kind of have that consciousness at the underlying part of a communal group. We had talked about that a little bit when we discussed Burning Man earlier on a different show and things like that. And I was just wondering, Oh, and also, interestingly enough, I know we weren't going to get into drugs, but MDMA, when they were using it early on by psychologists, was actually called empathy. And that is something that the rave culture tends to open each other up to each other in this very communal experience. And I was wondering if you had had any, like, personal experience where you really felt at a rave that there was a group mind, if you had the experience that it literally became like a singular consciousness. Did you ever, like, kind of feel that happen?
Certainly. I think this is one of the experiences that has drawn me back to conducting more formal research on this experience, and I think it's been that drives people back. I mean, I guess it's encapsulated in the word, you know, the vibe.
Mm.
And for me, I don't approach the vibe I mean, I think the vibe should be taken quite seriously. In fact, my book Technomad is in large part an exercise in attempting to undertake a kind of archaeological investigation of the vibe, or an anthropological investigation as well. And so that looks at the history of this social aesthetic that has evolved, especially within electronic dance music, that participants wish to, and promoters wish to optimize and re-optimize, and such that it has evolved from disco, or pre-proto-disco in the late 60s and into the 70s, to global psytrance festivals such as the Boom Festival. But for me, the experience of the vibe is quite complex, because we're talking about a multiple range of social aesthetics, from transgressive experiences, that is the almost the Dionysian moments of dissolution of the self in the context of others, that is totally removed from the rules and regulations of everyday life, right through to progressive vibes, so events that are held for certain purposes other than that which is experienced in the present. So where dance parties and trance events are held for progressive means, whether it's ecological or humanitarian purposes and so on. And so so on a spectrum of vibes, if you like, we have social aesthetics that are more spiritual in intent, such as a desire to be removed from, or to experience freedoms from that which is experienced to be oppressive in one's daily lives.
So there's another dimension to it that seemed that I noticed sort of right off the bat, is a kind of playing with an apocalyptic dimension. I mean, there's always been an apocalypse dimension to psychedelic culture, which means at once a sense of all of history coming to some revelatory moment, as well as a sense that our modern industrial civilization is approaching some kind of breakdown, or even just a sense of transcendence of normal history, that there's something special about the time, or the revolution is about to happen. And this is a big trope you find in reading about the 60s experience, and it carries through in some ways, in as part of the same vibe, and it's been something specific with Psytrance in my experience as well, where the producers of the music, the samples they use, the kind of rhetoric around some of it, and by apocalyptic I don't just mean like the end of the world in a like science fictional sense, but really that sense of some final revelation or some that there's an enormous transformation right around the bend, whether it's in consciousness or in culture or in civilization as a whole. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you sense that changing even over the years that you've been doing research? Is it growing more intense now? Are people learning to live with that framework? It's always seemed to me a very important dimension of the experience.
Yes, to me, I think. Especially in the larger gatherings where people are traversing the planet to be at certain places in certain times, there is a greater sense of momentum and purpose and significance in those moments, that people invest so much in those moments. But for me, the experience, I guess, is quite complex. I mean, it is as complex and diverse as there are people who enter the vibe. I mean, so unlike a rite of passage where we can predict the outcome, where we can see that there's some sort of telos where there will be a predicted outcome, where we can understand that individuals will experience new roles and responsibilities as a result of experiencing this event. With dance parties and larger festivals, there are as many outcomes as there are individuals who experience the event, but quite often with some of these events where there are themes, people will they'll dress for the occasion, they'll have costumes, they'll have certain things in mind where they wish to experience an outcome that is somewhat more collective. And so I think there are more ritually orientated events around the globe where the organizers have a certain sense of intent. And I think, to me, they're some of the more interesting events. Rainbow Serpent has some degree a sense of intent in terms of a kind of post-colonial intent with the involvement of indigenous people. It's also interesting that Burning Man, which is of course not a dance festival and not a trance festival, of course, also has, even though there's no certain sense of underlying or overarching meaning for the burn itself. Each year, of course, there is a theme, and many theme camps and operatives and people within this temporary city will conduct themselves according to this theme. And so I think the theme is really interesting, and perhaps we can look back to the ritual festival of Eleusis, and I think that there is quite a few people who have made some comparisons between Burning Man and Eleusis, and some people now making such comparisons with Boom and Eleusis. And so we're talking about a mystery ritual which also has a very sort of singular form of intent. And and that's interesting. I think that's interesting to explore the comparisons between this ancient 2,000-year-old Greek ritual, which I think has had a lot of significance for the contemporary West, and some of these contemporary events that are attempting to replicate or reproduce that type of experience.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's interesting in that tension that says a lot about where we are as a in the West in terms of trying to integrate spirituality or larger cosmic views into what are still fairly rational and, you know, post-Enlightenment subjectivities, is this tension between religion and something unnameable or something even purely secular. Because if a large organization, you know, a large event, a large festival had a very explicit and specific kind of spiritual agenda, i.e. if their intention was so specific, then it would look like a cult. And it would feel like a cult. And people who were into it would get really into that identification, and the people who were not were like, oh my God, this is too creepy. So there's only so far you can go. And then on the other side, you can bring people together and you dangle, you know, the chintzy iconography of spirituality as a lure, but actually all you're doing is completely kind of just crass, throwing a party, making money, you know, getting off your face or whatever it is. And that's a side of it too. So it seems to me that these festivals, they have to find, or they're seeking this kind of sweet spot where there's enough attentionality and enough focus that something transformative can actually happen, at least for some of the people who are going. And yet, if it can't go too far, because then it gets kind of culty and weird, unless it's at a small enough scale that people can be informal and still really focused. So it's just, in a way, it's a reflection of a larger dynamic where people are trying to figure out ways to collectively experience and affirm religious or spiritual ideas and experiences, but also just concepts of the world, and yet do it in a way that's still DIY enough, that's still open-ended, that's still experiential enough that it doesn't congeal into something a little weird. And you, along these lines, I can't help but ask you about 2012 and how you feel that, how you've seen the idea that, you know, some quasi-apocalyptic or transformative event is going to happen in this particular time. And I know that idea, you know, is now widespread in all sorts of scenes, but certainly a very powerful one among a lot of the people who go, travelers and people who go to psytrance events and things. How do you, from your anthropological, archaeological perspective, look at the way a meme or an idea like 2012 organizes people's desires or their speculations or their experience?
Well, I think it's one among many of memes that have become prominent, and I guess increasingly prominent over the last 10 years, and I guess that's sort of grown with psytrance, and certainly at psytrance events around the world, I've seen, you know, the Planetary Art Network, who are associated with the Dream Spell calendar, the Movement for Change, promote their ideas at various festivals, and you know, the certain glyphs and symbolisms associated with that calendar have become quite prominent, and Mayan symbolism and architecture has grown in prominence, and to me, this is quite a fascinating thing. But I guess there's so much differential investment in 2012 that we see people invest in different forms and modes of significance in the date of the 21st of December 2012. And but it's very much a progressive rather than an apocalyptic investment. So it fits right into post-60s new spiritual developments, whereby that particular date is associated with the evolution of consciousness and the bringing about of a better world. And so there's ecological and humanitarian investment in this date that I think is significant. And so, to me, it really does fit into that evolutionary scheme of the evolution of consciousness. And you know, very, very rarely do I encounter anyone in the psytrance and related visionary arts culture scenes that regard this as a particularly sort of apocalyptic moment in the sense that we're about to see massive devastation. It's more like it fits into the scheme of personal apocalypse or the radical transformation self that's associated with this the evolution of consciousness.
Do you sense that there's a kind of literalism in it, that because you're a historian and you can see the way that these ideas have come and gone, does it trouble you at all, or do you actually see it as just a kind of collective metaphor that allows certain possibilities to occur, and that the precise obsession about a particular date is not as important as the energies that it allows?
Well, I'm certainly interested in seeing it unfold. It will be a great excuse for a party. There's no doubt about that.
Well, where are you going to be?
It's likely that I'll be in Australia. I've been involved with a group called Earth Dream, and Earth Dream, which was co-founded by one of the founders of the Mutoid Waste Company, who have recycled industrial hard waste in across the world, but starting in the UK, as context for our parties. Robert Mutoid is one of the co-founders of this, moved to Australia in the early 90s and had this vision for a series of events beginning in 2000. And I was part of that journey through Central Australia right up to, spiraling right up the guts of the continent to Darwin, and also taking in East Timor. A series of events and parties that where we collaborated with Aboriginal peoples to hold these techno-corroborees. And since then, Robert Mutoid has inaugurated a space called Mutonia in northern South Australia, where he's built a plane henge, one of a series of henges that started with Carhenge in Glastonbury in the mid-80s. And since then, it's held several parties throughout the decade, and the key party will be a gathering on December the 21st, 2012, somewhere in Central Australia, we're told. I'm not quite sure where. It's going to be quite hot, but why not be there and see what happens?
What do you think will be like the implications of like all these raves all over at 2012? Do you think that'll actually help, like, spur the consciousness revolution? Like, are you a believer that in kind of that 100th monkey theory, that if we can get enough people going on in this trance state, like, with that in their intention, do you think that'll help push everybody else, like, over the edge?
Well, I have an investment in that idea. I believe that it certainly can help, that if thousands of people are intent on manifesting change in the world, and as subsequent to these events, which are in real time and also connected across the world, are I can't see why that wouldn't be important. And I know that people associated with the Earth Dance organization, who've been doing this for years, that is holding events that are synchronized across the planet, do believe that they are manifesting some significant change in the world that is associated with, I guess, transcendental meditation initially. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it does seem that the one of the things that's important about this music and to tune into it, even for people who don't go to festivals, is to listen to some psytrance really loud for, you know, at least a couple hours at a go, because it has a cumulative effect that's really particularly remarkable. It's just the way that the idea of synchrony, the idea of the beat as a kind of organization of global energies and global aspirations and global vision, is really articulated to my mind better than anywhere else. I mean, whether it's a crazy post-hippie new age fantasy, or it's some part of a genuine technologically enhanced but also very tribal kind of consciousness, it's definitely a happening thing and has only been growing. And yet it remains, as the subtitle of your book has it, a counterculture. It's in some ways it's kind of off the radar of people outside the scene, either also people who are into other kinds of electronic music or dance music or pop music or rock music. It's kind of in its own world, which in a way is one of the powerful things about it, because it's not just like everything else.
Well, yes, indeed, and I think that the word tribal has become quite prominent within psytrance. Is one of those tropes that has flourished, and it's this desire, I guess, for that. I mean, one of the key things that interests me is that participants in screen age cultures that are experiencing forms of, you know, isolation from other people and kind of depersonalization in their everyday life, desire to be with others, and they desire to be with others in contexts where they're outside of themselves. And when they're outside of themselves, then boundaries between themselves and others are dissolved, and so there's a sense of synchronicity that over millennia of centuries, but certainly more concentrated in recent times, I believe, certainly since the 60s, have sought to reoptimize and has been very desirable. So what we're experiencing is this sort of flourishing of the Dionysia in modern times, and part of that, of course, is the experience for altered states of mind and embodiment, and without a doubt these are some of the more collective states of altered mind and embodiment that we've seen. And it's not just countercultural, of course, it's right in the mainstream. I mean, I think clubbing is probably one of the more prominent leisure pursuits across the world, and we see massive clubs and environments in cosmopolitans and other places around the world where the interior design of these spaces is designed to enhance altered states of consciousness, even for people who may not have experienced mind alterance. So these spaces become assemblages whereby all the resources and technologies and multimedia is designed to optimize alternate states of experience. And I think that this is it's certainly from an anthropological perspective of great significance.
Very much so, and I'm glad you are noting the many ways in which that kind of logic is playing itself out today. It's definitely not just located inside of the scene, but it's more that it seems that there's a particular intensity, a particular intentionality within the space, an embrace of the full range of the collective possibilities of altered states and and their sort of design that through music and through lights and through the organization of festivals that really makes this an incredibly fascinating subculture. And just to remind folks that Graham St. John is the author of the new book Technomad, Global Raving Countercultures, and he also has a piece out in the new Dance Cult Journal, which is available online at djdancecult.net. Is there any other URLs you want to throw at people, Graham?
I guess you could check out www.edcentral.net, which is my main website. So all of my stuff, projects, publications can be found there.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for joining us today, Graham. It's been great. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou for Expanding Mind, reminding you to keep your minds open.